This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today is a show very close to my heart because it really has to do with what this program is all about. In fact, when I first pitched the idea of Finding Your Bliss to Zoomer Radio, a huge component of the program was all about yoga and looking for ways to help people find and experience greater levels of peace and tranquility in their lives. And while we've done episodes about yoga and mindfulness before, I was literally trembling and so excited when I started reading celebrated yoga teacher Rima Datta's profoundly significant book, The Yogi's Way, Transform Your Mind, Health, and Reality. So what's so different about Rima's book? Well, I think what's really different is that Rima's book explains it all in a way that I've never understood before and really brings it all together. It could even be a teacher training course in itself for everyone from the beginner to the advanced teacher or student of yoga. There's so many reasons to celebrate this book, and I can't wait to dive into all of it today with this incredibly gifted yoga teacher and author. But suffice it to say, in this book, there are so many valuable lessons and insights, including the 12 pillars that she highlights, which are community, breath, healthy thoughts, mantra, visualization, meditation, movement, rest, journaling, communication, nutrition, and service, which is all about joy. Yoga, which means to join or to yoke, is something I've always known as a practice that can have an incredible transformative and positive influence on your life. And today, I think this is an episode that could change your life. I invite you all to sit back, relax, and enjoy this meaningful journey. But before we meet our guest, let me tell you a little bit more about her. Rima Datta is a teacher, speaker, and mantra singer based in Taos, New Mexico. She's also the author, as I just mentioned, of The Yogi's Way, Transform Your Mind, Health, and Reality. She found The Yogi's Way to offer a holistic and healing approach to yoga, emphasizing emotional well-being as a cornerstone to transformation. Rima is a certified Ashtanga yoga and Tibetan heart yoga instructor, and she's an Ayurvedic therapist. Where did she learn all of this? This is really comes naturally because Rima first learned yoga and Ayurveda from her mother and grandmothers, as well as her grandfather. I'm forgetting to breathe because I'm so blown away by this, who wrote several books on Vedic philosophy. Although Rima was born in the U.S., she and her family moved back to India when she was only 8 years old, and she was raised in a family of yogis between the U.S. and India, immersed in Vedic wisdom from birth. Her grandmother, an Ayurvedic practitioner, embodied tremendous resilience in the face of adversity. We'll talk about that later on. While her grandfather, a Vedic scholar, introduced her to yoga philosophy and pranayama. From the womb, she was surrounded by her mother's mantra singing. Her education was impressive. After receiving her master's from the London School of Economics, Rima worked for the UN in New York City before leaving to study ancient yoga wisdom and practice. The story of how she got there is fascinating. Since 2002, she has taught yoga and Ayurvedic workshops, retreats, and training in 20 countries across 5 continents. Her students include Sting, Paul Simon, Eddie Breckel, Zainab Salbai, Sujatha Balaga, and thousands of other practitioners globally. We'll talk to you about all the ways you can connect with her at the end of the show. Rima Datta, welcome to Finding Your Bliss.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rima, it seems like you came to all of this very naturally. You were born in Maryland into a family of yogis, as you write. Your parents emigrated to the U.S. from India in 1969, 7 years before you were born. And it seems like you had yoga in your DNA. You said that as a baby, You write, I heard my mother sing Sanskrit mantras from the yoga tradition. They became my childhood lullabies. You also learned Ayurvedic cooking from your mother and grandmothers. Your grandfather had a passion for yoga philosophy and wrote many books about it. You also learned pranayama breathing from him, that yoga breathing techniques. And your bedtime stories you write were renditions of classic yoga texts such as the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishad. But I don't think it was until after 9/11, you'd been working at the UN in New York, you went to San Francisco and you stumbled on a yoga studio that you felt very drawn to. You walked into the room. There were 40 people practicing Ashtanga. The yoga studio was called It's Yoga, owned by Larry Schultz. And you were blown away by the class that you experienced. Can you tell us what happened that day and how it led you to not only working as a teacher there, but how it really launched your yoga journey, as it were, and changed the course and trajectory of your life?
Yeah, that was quite a moment. I had just moved to San Francisco, and the first few days I lived there, I would just walk the city. You know, it's such a beautiful city to walk. So I just walked for hours every day. And then one day I saw this sign called It's Yoga in downtown. And I just walked in, and there was actually, I didn't take the class. There was a class happening, and it was a two-story building, and the class was on the second story. So I just peeked my head up. And there were 40 people doing, I didn't know then it was called Ashtanga, but they were doing Pattabhi Joyce, the sequence of Ashtanga yoga. And I had never witnessed that. And I just thought it was beautiful. Like I saw these people moving in sync and they were so strong and focused and just the vibe was just amazing. I was like, what are they doing? You know? And so the next day I went to the studio. And I asked them, I said, there was no class going on. There was just a couple of people working there. So I said, you know, yesterday I came, I peeked my head into this class. What were you doing? That was so beautiful. And then they explained, they said, oh, that's called Ashtanga yoga as taught by Pattabhi Joyce in Mysore. And I was like, you know, I would really love to learn that sequence. I practice yoga, but never like that. And they said, oh, well, you know, there is a training coming up and you're welcome to take it. And I remember distinctly saying, but I have no intention to teach. Like I'm just between jobs right now. And I do have a window, like that timing could work, but I don't know if I should do a teacher training because I don't intend to teach. And they said, that's no problem. Half of our students who do this training don't teach. It's just for themselves. So I took the training. It was a 1 month training and it was honestly, it was 99% asana. But yes. For me, that was perfect because I grew up with all the other elements of yoga. Yes. And very little asana. I did some gentle asana with my mom growing up, but nothing like Ashtanga. So the very last day of the training, when we were doing our closing circle, after that, I wrote a letter to the studio owner, to Larry Schultz. And I said, thank you. That was such an amazing experience. I feel so grateful. And I just have a few suggestions of some things you could bring to your studio. And I remember that letter. I made a little bullet point list. And I just said, I wrote things like Ayurveda, nutrition, mantra, pranayama, history, philosophy, things like that. And then the next day, Larry asked me, he's like, would you have lunch with me? And I was like, sure. And he said, I want to hire you to bring all this to my studio. And I honestly, when I wrote that letter, I didn't even have myself in mind. I actually said no at first because I was so young. I was like 25. And I said, you know, we live in the Bay Area. I'll help you find someone. And he was just so insistent. And he was like, no, I want you. I want you to bring this to my students. Wow. And so I did. And my first gig was like giving a talk to his teacher trainees on mantra and then led to another one on history and then philosophy. And then he just hired me full time. And it was so unexpected.
And he got you to write the manual for the teacher training, the second level manual, which is like, wow.
The second level, right? Which was so bizarre. I was like, I'm just you know, starting out, but it worked out and it was just a beautiful, it was such a win-win because I was also learning, you know, I was getting stronger in my body than I had ever been. And I loved it. It was a beautiful exchange.
And it's so incredible how it all came together. And when he asked you this at the lunch, did it land in a very deep place? I know you didn't want to do it at first, but just the compliment and the acknowledgement of what he saw in you, did that sort of resonate with you and make you go, wow?
You know, that didn't hit me for years later. You know, as really? Things, I think at that moment I was just shocked and kind of like, no way. Because it's also a cultural thing where our family are in India, it's yoga teachers are usually elderly. You know, they've retired or they teach from decades of experience. So it just felt odd. Like, I'm too young to be a teacher, you know, to be in that role. But after that, so many things kind of snowballed and I did start teaching quite a bit and it became my life and just one workshop after the other and trainings. And then years later, when I looked back, I was like, I wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for him. And like, he did see something that I was oblivious of. And I owe a lot to him.
Wow. But what a beautiful, I love it because it's so interesting. Like, what I love about your book, and I don't know if I communicated this off the top, is that it made yoga make sense to me in a way I've never experienced before. And I did a 200-hour yoga teacher training, which was excellent, but I was not clear on many things that are clear to me because of your book. And you've just mentioned it, that it's not just asanas, which are one of the poses, which are one of the eight limbs. And it's not just about the breath, which we did some breathing off of the top. It's about so much more. There are six other limbs. And your book really helps us unpack what they are and see how we can use yoga to help us understand not only the dynamics of yoga, but the teachings of the mind. And even though I think everyone just knows that you're going to experience more peace of mind just by doing yoga or by lying in Shavasana at the end of a yoga sequence, this book also helps you. And I want everyone to hear this because this is such important stuff. Find ways to overcome harmful thoughts and emotions and parts of the mind that get in the way of tranquility and peace and everything that yoga is supposed to be, which I know is a spiritual discipline, which includes breath control, meditation, some postures, and ultimately optimum health and relaxation. But it seems in this book, you fuse together, you join the definition of yoga, you fuse it all into more than just meditation and postures, but you integrate all of the profound teachings that you learned in your childhood. So it's incredible. You spent time in India deeply studying yoga at a very difficult time in your life. Can you tell us about that experience? And also, having lived and practiced yoga in India and in the US, what differences did you notice and how has each culture shaped your approach?
Wow, those are two big questions.
I know.
But maybe I'll start backwards. I guess some of the main differences between learning yoga with my Indian family and in the West, I can start with that. My Indian family and teachers, I think what the main thing is just that feeling of devotion, which I do feel amongst Westerners sometimes, you know, and oftentimes, but not all the time. Whereas in India and with my family, it's like the center is just that feeling of like, yeah, just devotion and that we're practicing, but it's for a larger purpose than our own even peace of mind or health of body. You know, so in our scriptures, it's that like the health of mind and body is seen not as an end to itself, but as a foundation for spiritual connection and growth and increased consciousness. And that's something that is just in the air. It's like when we're practicing, it's almost like it's a prayer, mm-hmm. You know, the practice. It's holy, very sacred. So that's just a given. I think one thing that I really appreciate about my teachers in the West and my colleagues here is there's this emphasis I felt, at least with my teachers, my Western teachers, on freedom on an individual level, like really honoring ourselves, making sure our life is, we're living in integrity. And yeah, that's something that's equally important, you know? And so I think, and this is just my experience, so no generalizations, but you know, with culture, it's beautiful that in India, yoga, it is a culture, you know, and culture is beautiful on so many levels. And sometimes when you're honoring culture, it gets tricky to also honor your individual spirit. like that's been a, that used to be in my 20s, at least, a struggle. It's like, I want to honor my culture, but I also want to honor my individuality. Mm. And so I feel like I've learned how to do that from both cultures, like through blending both cultures. And yeah. I find that that's actually, even when I look at the yoga teachings, it's like, yes, honor the heritage and honor the culture, but also honor your creative principle. You know, it's a balance of both. So
your Bhagavad Gita mm-hmm. is very similar, I guess, to the Bible or to the Torah in Judaism. It's rules to live by, but how would you describe it? Because I experienced it in a very different way through your book, in a very meaningful way. I really understood that mm-hmm. this helps you know how to live your life, yogically and otherwise, unless they're yeah. the same thing. I don't know. But how would yeah. you describe what the, like in simple terms that, mm. you know, really the layman can understand, because not everyone listening is a yoga person. And even I who sure. studied yoga and meditation want yes. to know more. Mm-hmm. And every yoga class teacher training course teaches you one version of the Bhagavad Gita. But there was something about your book that really explained it in a way that was, I got it. Mm. I want to see if I was right.
Oh, yeah, it's such a beloved text. And for those of you who it's new to, it's a story of, it's a dialogue between a teacher and a student. And the reason it's so loved is because almost every human being can relate to the student. And the student, Arjun, is having a really hard time. He's actually considered like the greatest warrior of the land. But even him, who's like so strong and brave, usually he's just having this moment where he's kind of falling apart. And he's like, there's all this description in the book, but he falls to the floor and he has his bow and arrow in his hand and the bow just falls to the ground. And he's shaking and he's sweating and he can't even get up. Like he's feeling so much anxiety and confusion and self-pity and doubt and fear. And all he wants is to do the right thing. You know, like he has a decision to make. It affects everyone that he loves, all his family, all the people on the land that he cares so deeply about. And he just has no idea what to do. And I feel like all of us have been in that place, you know, at some point in our lives, just overcome with confusion and emotion. And so it's so beautiful because towards the beginning of the book, there's just this moment of complete humility. And he just turns to Krishna, who's his childhood friend. And he says, Krishna, like, please help me. I don't know what to do. Which is yeah. so beautiful to me because it's that moment of humility is what opened up the whole book. The whole rest of the book is just Krishna sharing wisdom to help Arjun, wisdom and practices to help Arjun understand what's going on in his mind and to not push away the anxiety or the fear, or the confusion, but to actually really be with it and to look at it and to go to the depths of it and then start to come out of it, you know, and come to clarity. So by the end of the book, Arjun, you know, and the whole book is this dialogue. And what's also beautiful about it, it's like Krishna starts out as Arjun's friend, but as the book progresses, he kind of becomes more of a teacher. And like Arjun didn't even know. He was like, I didn't know my friend was so much wisdom. I had no idea. But one of Krishna's teachings, which is just so exquisite, is that because Arjun's seeing all this light and wisdom, and Krishna's like, but you have that same light and wisdom within yourself. And so do each and every one of us. He was like, I'm not special. Like, we all have this within us.
Yeah.
It just gets blocked sometimes. We get disconnected from it sometimes. So the practices he shares with Arjun is just how to remove the blocks and connect with his own wisdom. And by the end of the book, Krishna never tells Arjun what to do. But Arjun figures it out because he's cleared the way to his own wisdom. Mm-hmm. That's the path of yoga. It's like clear the blocks in the mind, clear the blocks in the body so that each of us can connect with our own light and okay. unlock it.
So you were in your light, you were happy. And I think it was somewhere in your 30s that you had some devastation in your personal life. And to heal, I think. I'm not even sure if that was the motivation, but what led you to India and what happened with deepening your practice there? Like, can you tell us about that?
Yes, this was about 10 years ago. My daughter was about 3 and she's 13 now. So, nice. So it's easy to do the math. but at that time, I had gone through a separation with her father. And that was a very painful time for me. I was going through a lot of loss, like the loss of my home. I ended up, she and I moved out of the house we were living. And then the loss of my partnership and just the family unit. You know, it all just felt like really huge, overwhelming losses. And I started to experience a lot of difficult emotions, just anger.
Kleshas.
Yeah, in the book I talk about kleshas, which are defined in the yoga texts as mind poisons or destructive emotions. Yeah. And just to be clear, it's also a clear teaching in these texts that no emotion is good or bad in and of itself.
Yes.
But it's the way we experience and express our emotions that makes them either harmful or wholesome, you know? So every emotion is fine, but they can lead to harm if we experience them in certain ways. So I just noticed that I was experiencing a lot of anger and a lot of shame and anxiety and fear and attachments, all of these kleshas. And I realized I was experiencing them in harmful ways because they were draining my energy. I was feeling really low. And so I knew deep down that the deeper philosophical teachings of yoga can help with these emotions. Yeah. But I honestly felt disconnected from those teachings. Yeah. And so I had been studying, Ramana Maharishi has been one of my main teachers for a long time, for most of my path, and his teachings focus on pure consciousness, the very depths of our soul, the quietness and the stillness that is there, and how connecting with that place can help us move through challenging emotions. And so I thought, I'm really having a hard time. I need to really immerse myself in these teachings. And so I decided to go to his ashram. And I stayed for about a month, and it was very difficult because my daughter, at that time, she was 4, by then about 4.5. But that's very young. That's hard to leave your 4.5-year-old for a month.
Yes.
But I felt that I really needed it. And so I went, and luckily, a mutual friend had connected me to 2 yoga teachers who were there at that same time. So I met them, and we started to practice asana and pranayama every morning. Mm-hmm. We'd get up at 5 and just do an hour of asana, an hour of pranayama, pretty, you know, deep practices. They're also instructors. The 3 of us would practice deeply and every day, you know, consistently, which as you know, it's powerful to practice consistently.
Of course.
And so I would do that in the morning. By nine, I was at the ashram. I would spend the whole day just meditating, reading, studying, singing mantra, walking, visiting the sites where Ramana Maharishi meditated. And it was amazing to just be in the energy of so many practitioners just sincerely devoted to their practice and to experiencing pure consciousness. And so I think just being in that energy for one solid month was really shifted things for me. And I share in the book how I had a moment of, I had this opportunity to really put into practice Ramana Maharishi's teachings, which is basically to embrace yourself moment to moment. His teachings are very centered on the present moment, being present and not fighting, not resisting anything that's arising in the present moment. Mm-hmm. You know, so whether it's anger or pain or sorrow or sadness or these difficult emotions that as humans we tend to brush aside because they're so hard to face and feel. But I really was embracing his teachings. I'm like, okay, no resistance, no labeling this good or bad or right or wrong, just feeling the fullness of what's arising. And I had a moment of really doing that. And I was kind of like Arjun. I was shaking and crying and full of tears and emotion, but it really helped me to release all that I was holding. And I could really directly feel the power of those teachings of letting ourselves abide in that pure consciousness.
don't you talk about somewhere in the book, you heard a woman crying, and I'm wondering if it was during that period. And at first you were like, oh my gosh, stop, get control of yourself. And then you realized that's kind of what you needed to do. And it almost gave you permission.
Absolutely. Right? It's so amazing to look back at that moment because, I mean, I try to, you know, I'm human, so I don't always have great thoughts. So I was at the ashram sitting, meditating, and there was a woman sitting quite close to me at this ashram, and she was crying and she was being so loud. and I was just in my mind being so judgmental. I was like, my God, this woman, like, she's so disturbing. Doesn't she know that we're supposed to be quiet? What the heck? And then I just let those thoughts come and go. And then I started going into my meditation and I started crying. And then, like, I don't know, you know, time is so funny when you're meditating. So I don't know if it was 2 seconds later or 2 minutes later, but I was the one crying almost as loudly as her. Yeah. And I was like, oh my gosh, she must have been this angel giving me permission to just really, like Ramana Maharshi teaches us to really be with what's arising, like really let it be.
Yes.
Because that's what I did. And I let myself. And I think she really helped me.
Wow.
You know, to
that's
do that.
So incredible. You know, I want to go back to these kleshas and tell me if I'm correct in this. It's a mental state that clouds the mind and can lead to unhealthy actions. So anger, jealousy, attachment, anxiety, sorrow, confusion, and how we can learn to replace these and how to move through these kleshas, find out what triggers them and replace them with their opposite, which is non-attachment, wisdom, compassion, and equanimity. Am I getting this? Is that correct? Because I almost feel like bliss is the opposite of kleshas. I don't know if that's accurate, but to get to that state of bliss, you need to be in a state of non-attachment and witnessing.
We'll be right back after this short commercial break. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi everyone, this is Finding Your Bliss. And just before the break, I was asking Rima Datta about kleshas and how we can avoid these negative feelings and thoughts.
Witnessing the kleshas is one way to just not be so entangled in them. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to let the emotions be, to get out of that habit of resisting them, but to actually let them be. And when you witness, you can step back a little bit and just see them coming and going, which is one of the practices in the book, that we become the witness. And what's great about that is then you can notice that these emotions are actually temporary. In our minds, we think, I am scared, or I am anxious, or I am this and that, and we get attached to these labels. But when you become the witness, you can really see directly that it's not just a concept that this stuff is temporary, but you can directly experience that, oh, this emotion is here and it's intense for a moment or for many moments, but then it shifts and it changes. And then there's the next thing, you know? So becoming a witness is very powerful to let yourself be with what is. And the kind of flavor with the being that consciousness adds to is when, you know, when you meditate, and you touch that stillness within yourself, then you feel that this consciousness is actually like a loving energy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this energy that just allows whatever is to be. It's not trying to change it. It's not trying to label it good or bad. It's a very loving energy. And I quote one of my other great teachers, Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, in the book, but his quote sticks with me so much because I find it to be so true. He says that that space of consciousness, it morphs into love, you know, into this all-embracing, all-pervading love. So we meet our kleshas from the seat of consciousness, so from this loving presence. And so I offer this in the book, is that, you know, when we meet our kleshas, it's like being with a small child who's hurting. And you just hold the child and you give it tenderness and affection and you let it cry. You let it, you know.
You don't yell when they cry. You let them cry it out in your arms. I love that part in the book when you talk about that. And then they just not only simmer down, but they just settle and they feel that love and they calm down on their own.
They relax on their own.
Yeah, that was
beautiful. Their whole body shifts, you know.
That was a beautiful parenting moment in the book. That was gorgeous, yeah.
Because as we know, like if you say, hey, kids, shut up, they're just going to get louder. You know, that doesn't work.
Totally.
You just have to like let them.
And you learned that as well. And I love this because you have taught, and we've mentioned some of the huge celebrities that you've taught, and you've done some very deep yoga practice with people as a teacher and mentor and like a guru of sorts. And this book and so much more and teacher training and on and on. So I was fascinated when you went to your child's school and agreed to teach kindergarten to grade six classes. And you were worried about it because it's true when you're a master and you're used to teaching adults to teach kids suddenly. And what you couldn't get over was how they were never quiet. They were difficult. And just how you moved through that was so graceful and so beautiful. And how ultimately you realize there's going to be days that are just joyful and epiphanies of grace and love and calm. You got them to be calm. But then there's going to be other days that are going to be like, oh my God, get me out of here, right? But how much did you learn from that experience of teaching children, like what it called upon you to be and become?
Yeah, it's so beautiful how life offers us these opportunities to turn these teachings that are like concepts into experiences and realizations. I think we probably all heard and read and maybe know on some level that that life is just up and down. You know, that's the nature of life. And I think what turned into a realization from this experience with the kids is what is written in the Gita, that life will always be up and down. Like there's no escape from that. But we can cultivate peace within ourselves and we can be okay. Like, okay, today the class is really difficult. Today the class is really easy. Like not get judgmental.
Attached, right?
You know, not get attached when the class is easy and not judge yourself when the class is difficult. But just accept that life is up and down. There's so much we can't control, but we can be okay. We can be anchored in that okayness as we navigate the ups and downs.
So can I ask you, Rima, more about your brainchild, The Yogi's Way, your beautiful book, Transform Your Mind, Health, and Reality. Did it pour out of you? Was it painstaking? Because this is like everything that you learned from the East, the West, your entire life as a little child, baby, listening to lullabies and Ayurvedic cooking. This was everything. And it's like you put it all together. And I've never seen, I don't know how to explain this, but I've never seen yoga put all together in a way where you go, my goodness, I can practice and not just do the breath, but I can do mantra, I can visualize, I can do all of this in one practice. So it's not just about one limb or two limbs, it's about all of it. And it's really what yoga is all about. Was it something that took you years to do? Did it come pouring out of you for a couple of weeks where you couldn't stop writing and you didn't sleep? How did this book evolve?
That's a great question. I've had it in me for a couple decades. I remember even teaching workshops before my daughter was born. And some students, I loved the philosophy. I loved the Bhagavad Gita and the teachings of the Upanishads and the classic ancient texts. So even when I taught workshops, I would bring that in and have like an afternoon where we go into the wisdom teachings. And so some students would say, Rima, you've got to put that into a book. Like this stuff is so juicy, you know? And so there were a lot of seeds planted, but I think it wasn't until I had my daughter And I went through those tough years. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until then that I appreciated how much the wisdom works, because mm-hmm. I needed it so much. You know, I was struggling so much in my mind that I really needed to learn how to navigate these emotions and how to not just connect with consciousness for a moment, but really deepen my connection with it and be able to anchor myself in it as I navigated the difficulties of life. You know, during that time, what also happened is so many of my good friends are yoga teachers or have been on the path for decades. And they were also going through hard times, like losing a loved one or going through divorces. And so it really occurred to me that like something is missing. Like I'm struggling in my mind, like my colleagues who have such deep practices, there's some elements of yoga that we need to bring back. There's some of this wisdom that we really need to work on applying into our practice and life. And I was doing that, and then I was sharing it with my friends. And I started to, you know, teach a teacher training. I called it Yoga for Emotional Healing. And then when, as I wrote the curriculum for that, and as I started teaching it, it resonated with so many people, and I was helping so many people. And I still had a small child, like my daughter was 6, 7 yeah. by that time. So I thought, I know I was starting to travel and teach a little bit more as she got a little older, but it was still minimal. And I realized if I write a book, maybe I can reach a lot more people, because there's only so much I can travel, you know? And my daughter at that age, oh my gosh, I would go for a weekend workshop and she would be like, Mommy, don't go. She'd be like, cancel it, don't go. I was so heartbroken. So yes. I was like, okay.
I remember those years. I have a daughter right? too. And I remember those times yeah. of, and we still have it, but she lives somewhere else, but we're very, very connected. Yeah. But I remember those times that they don't want you to go. Mommy, please don't
yes,
go.
I know.
And Mommy, thank yeah. God you're back.
right.
Yeah. So that was so smart. So you sat down and then once you made up your mind and you created that intention, did it sort of all come tumbling out of you?
You know, a lot of it flowed out. I had all the content for a while. Mm-hmm. The hardest thing for me was the organization of it and the balance, because I didn't want to write a book just on yogic philosophy, and I didn't want to write a memoir. There was three main things. There was my story.
Yes.
And then the wisdom teachings, and then the practices.
Yes.
Because as you know, at the end of each chapter, there's a set of practices so yes. that the reader can bring those practices into their lives. And
I have to just say this to the listener that the book is divided into 12 weeks and it's so beautifully delineated. And there's a section on mantra, and there's a section, every part that you ever want to know about on service and joy and every part of this journey. And then at the end, there's like 15 steps of what that practice entails. And then some key words, like some definitions of difficult words that we don't know. And it's so easy to do and to reread and come back to. And like, you should see my book, it's all dog-eared and, I feel like it's kind of the epitome of what a yoga book that really encompasses what yoga really is in every single way is. And the meditations in the book that people can do, which I might actually ask you, we don't have a lot of time, but the wisdom meditation, there's also the space meditation.
Would it be possible for you to lead us in a short meditation?
Okay, so let's do a short meditation. So you can just get comfortable in your seat on the floor or your chair, just whatever's comfortable for you. Let's take a couple big, deep breaths, big belly breaths. And as you breathe slowly and deeply, you can take your gaze up to the third eye, which is the pineal gland. So if you find the space right between your eyebrows, go up about an inch and in about an inch, and just gaze at that space behind your forehead. And notice that that space has no beginning. It has no end. It's boundless. It's this infinite space. See if you can just rest your gaze on that spaciousness. Relax the body. And one of the essential teachings of yoga philosophy is that we are not our bodies. We are not our minds. We're not our thoughts or emotions or sensations. But who we truly are is infinite, boundless. And we might place labels on ourselves of being this and that. But one of the things we can do in our one way to meditate and to free ourselves of the labels that I am this, I am that, is just look at the space behind your forehead and just remember this ultimate truth that I am, essentially, I am boundless. I am infinite. My soul is eternal. At my essence, I am unchanging, just like the space behind your forehead. So there may be a day where I feel anger. There may be a day where I feel sorrow. There may be a moment where I feel shame. But whatever arises in the space, whether it's pleasant or painful, the space itself is unchanging, right? Unaffected, undamageable. The yogis are saying, this is who you truly are. So whatever comes and goes in the space of your mind or your heart, be anchored here in this infinite space of your true self. And it's a practice, you know, it's a practice to do every day, get more and more familiar with that space and be able to dwell in that space. It's such a practice.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Thank you so much. Wow. And that's available also on your website. Is that correct? That you can actually access it? How can people do that?
So when you get the book and you'll see there's practices at the end of each chapter, you can read the exercises and do them, but you can also jump onto my website and I'll take you through the mantras and the meditations so you can have that experience.
Rima also offers 1 hour yoga sessions, 30 minutes. Is that correct? Privates and
yes,
a teacher training, a 500 hour teacher training course, which I'm really interested in. I want to talk to you about at the end, but there's so much. What you also do that's very different in this book, Rima, and in your work is you offer a feminine perspective, but the path isn't exclusively for women. It's for anyone who has struggled with their mind and is ready to transform it from a source of bondage to one of liberation. Can you say more about how you can go, again, from these kleshas, these destructive emotions, and the realization, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, of Svadharma, their unique purpose? Can you tell us more about your unique take on all of this?
Don't answer that just yet. We're going to hear more when we come back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio. And before the break, I was asking you, Rima, if you could say more about Svadharma.
I mean, actually, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna mentions to Arjun, the whole question is, what is my Svadharma? Which Arjun is struggling with. And Svadharma, it means the action that is right for you in this moment, you know, and it has a broader implication. Like, what are the gifts that you were born to give? What is your particular path, your particular purpose? As we get less and less afflicted by our kleshas, that becomes more clear. Like, what is my Svadharma and that I can honor it? And it's such a path, you know, to really honor your Svadharma, because often it might not be what's accepted by broader society, or it might be something you have to really carve your unique path to, you know. So lots of practices in the book to be able to get in touch with it and get some skills to really honor it.
How does Svadharma relate to Dharma and enlightenment and bliss?
Yeah, I think Dharma is like, in general, what's beneficial in life, what we can do that's beneficial for others versus not. Whereas Svadharma is pointing to our spirit, like our unique gift, our unique offering, and really discovering what that is and then nurturing it so that we can give it.
So Larry Schultz helped you find your Svadharma that day.
He absolutely did.
Right?
I had no idea, but he really did.
That's incredible. Not only is the book filled with wonderful lessons and practices and meditations and the Heal Yourself Now yoga sequence, which I want you to talk about in a moment. In fact, let's talk about that right now because I think that's so important. The Heal Yourself Now yoga sequence. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So the book culminates in a 70-minute sequence called Heal Yourself Now. And some of the main practices we've been doing in the book for those 12 weeks, a lot of the main ones we bring into the 70-minute practice. So there's a couple of mantras in the practice. There's a pranayama. There's a sequence of movement. And the movement is you learn how to understand the subtle body and how the asanas are influencing the chakras. So it's movement with some subtle body awareness. Mm-hmm. And also weaving in some mantras with the movement. Mm-hmm. So you have the mantras, the pranayama, the movement, and then there's some journaling practice, meditation. There's two main meditations.
Yes.
One is the witness meditation that we talked about, and then there's a consciousness meditation where we train to really dwell in that spaciousness that we touched upon.
That was lovely.
So there's those two meditations and Shavasana, of course, and then there's a couple of journaling practices.
Yes.
One of the journaling practices is a lot of us are familiar with the first two limbs of yoga, which are the yamas and niyamas. And we learn about them and we read about them. But this journaling practice, it makes us actually apply them to our lives and really contemplate how can we apply them. And we get to see, you know, what we're doing day to day. So there's a journaling practice to help us with those first two limbs. And there's another journaling practice with Ayurvedic awareness. So one of the chapters is Ayurveda. Yeah, building some awareness to help us with our nutrition and our health on those levels. And then there's also a bedtime visualization that the sequence ends with. So we do get into the power of visualization in the book.
It's incredible. It's like, it's gestalt, like it's just all of it. And it's so beautifully laid out and presented in a way that people can follow and then just relearn. And you can have a favorite chapter and come back to it, or a part that you're struggling with, you can come back to over and over again. And this is really a book, The Yogi's Way, for your bedside table. I know we're nearing towards the end and we're going to have to do another show with you. We're going to have to invite you on again because there's so much I want to talk about. But I just want to talk about your grandmother, because you talk about joy in a way that really makes the reader feel that joy. And in the chapter about finding joy in your life and living in service and celebration, living in service, being outward focused, which of course is the greatest bliss of all often. But I have to bring in your grandmother here because the way she lived her life was one of such beauty and inspiration. I love the story about how your grandmother had four daughters at a time in India where boys were preferred. She moved to Delhi with your grandfather, which was approximately a 15-hour train ride from her home. No friends, nobody there, 16 at the time when she was first pregnant. And she raised those daughters. And I love about how you talk about how she made friends and cultivated a community and celebrated the festivals and danced and sang. And the joy she felt going to the village every day to buy fresh vegetables every day. Can you say more about this true warrior, your grandmother, how she overcame her kleshas, and how much joy she carried with her in her daily life, and what we can learn from your grandmother? And I know you've learned a lot from her.
Yeah, I think about her so often because there's so much. It's so interesting to me because she never sat me down and said, here's some yogic wisdom and here's how you can apply it to your life.
Yes.
Just observing her and reflecting on her teaches me so much, you know. Mm-hmm. She had such a difficult life. Married at 14, taken out of school in the eighth grade. My daughter's 13, so it's unimaginable. You're a child, you know, to have your first child, then at 16, living nowhere near any family or support. So just real hardship. And then having four daughters, my grandfather lived abroad and worked abroad. So she really raised them on her own in a very patriarchal society. But what amazes me is that I, like so many people, we want the world to be a better place. We want equality. We want sexism, no racism. We want all these things and we work towards it. And it's so great that we are. And at the same time, what she teaches me is that even if we're living in an oppressive world, even if life is oppressive and difficult, we can find peace and joy yes. within ourselves, and we can bring that into our day-to-day lives.
Yes.
Like her Swadharma was to have a happy household for her daughters and to give them love and joy. And she cooked every meal from scratch and sewed their clothes. And my mom and her sisters, they just marvel at how much joy she was filled with day to day. It's just such a beautiful lesson because we're dealing with so much in the world right now. But joy is our birthright, to still find that joy in our children and our nature and yes. amongst our friends, and to cook and sew and dance and sing and, yeah. you know, all of that.
There's a beautiful picture of her in the book holding your mother on her lap, and how beautiful and peaceful it is, that picture. Your grandmother embodied the wisdom and essence of yoga, you write. She really yeah. embodied what this is all about. So mm-hmm. everyone has to read this book just to learn from your grandmother alone. There's, you made me excited to embrace yoga in a new and different way. There's also something so profound in your chapter on meditation when you talk about blessings, and you write, depending on your faith and what resonates with you, ask for blessings from your guides, from a higher power, from God, from your higher self. Visualize yourself receiving these blessings and feel yourself in your practice being blessed. Express gratitude for these blessings. Can you just say briefly something about blessings? Because I found that also, there's a lot of crying for me when I was reading your book.
Oh, yeah. Maybe because I grew up with yoga, I've always had this curiosity of other spiritual traditions. So I've learned, you know, from Native Americans and other shamans and other traditions. And one of the things I see that we all have in common is asking for blessings mm-hmm. from our guides, from our elders, our ancestors, mm-hmm. and just how beautiful and powerful that is. It's so hard to not do that, you know. So yoga and all of these traditions, you know, have this practice to really call in our guides, to even visualize them, to ask them, you know, to please stay close as we do these practices, because they're hard. You know, we're facing our anger, attachments. Like, this isn't all easy stuff, but our intention is good. We want to be of service to others. So yes. asking for blessings, it feels so real every day that I do that, wow. that I feel them close.
That's unbelievable. And so many things, guys, in this book, in week 7, it's called Choices, Become the Driver of the Mind Instead of Its Passenger. And you also suggest that we generate daily doses of joy. And this goes in the chapter, whole idea of service and celebration. Can you just say something briefly about that?
Yeah, there's the daily doses of joy. There's also a weekly joy practice that we do. That was inspired by the mythology in yoga. Like, there's so many stories of Ram and Krishna, Radha, Sita. They're like in the gardens singing to each other, playing the flute, you know, enjoying each other, enjoying nature. And I asked the readers to do, starting with a weekly joy practice, just to do something that brings your heart joy, whether that's like playing your favorite songs and dancing in your kitchen, or just something once a week to fill your spirit with joy. And just a reminder that as we deal with all the challenges in life, in our personal life and the collective, yes. to find those moments.
To find those moments. Mm-hmm. So, so true. What do you hope, Rima, most that your readers will take away from The Yogi's Way, Transform Your Mind, Health, and Reality?
Just my grandmother's teaching that peace is possible, especially when everything is chaotic and crazy.
Yes.
Of course, we want to change the world and we're working on it, but that power of cultivating peace within ourselves and then bringing it into our world and bringing it into our work, that's what we have control over, and that's what we can do. And let's do it.
Let's do it. Definitely. Let's do it. Yeah. There's a question that we ask everyone at the end of the show. And of course, we're going to ask you, what is bliss for Rima Datta?
Oh, I think it's spending time with my daughter, Yeah.
Lovely. What is the best way for people to contact you and connect with you on social media and get a copy of your beautiful book, The Yogi's Way?
The best way is the website, theyogisway.com. That links to everything, the book and the courses that are coming up. If you love the book and you want to experience the 12 weeks live, I'll be offering a 12-week course where we once a week gather online and go through the practices together. So that's coming up. That book comes out February 18th, but we'll start in March, this journey live together.
So I know that part of your bliss is singing mantra, and you have put out many albums. And there's a song that I loved. Can you set this up for us? Sata Nama.
Sata Nama. Yeah, that's it's a beautiful song. It's like saying the name of God or consciousness, that I am that, you know, that constant reminder. I'm not my body or my mind, but I am this pure, infinite consciousness.
Let's all have a little listen. That was so beautiful and so calming. And I love your voice. And I see that this brings you bliss to sing.
It does. It's my daughter and mantra, they're up there.
They're up there. I get that. I really get that. I want to make sure that I'm saying this right. Upanishad?
Yeah, Upanishads.
Yes. There's a beautiful quote, "What the mind dwells on, you become." What does that mean?
That's like everything, right? So, you know, we did that space meditation and saw that that infinite space is like the ultimate truth of our soul and the world, that it's just what quantum physicists say, like pure potentiality. And what the yogis say, which many wisdom traditions agree, is that the way we experience ourselves and the way we experience the world is based on what we place, the thoughts that we put into that space, you know? Mm. And so if we see ourselves as empowered and liberated and strong and healing, then that's what we end up experiencing, mm-hmm. right? But if we are down on ourselves, then that's what we experience. So we have so much, like we can recognize the thoughts that are hurting us, and we can recognize thoughts that empower us, and we can make our choices and make shifts accordingly. Okay. But that's how powerful we are, that what the mind dwells on, we become.
Rima, it was such an honor to have you on the show today. I want to really thank you so much for being here. It was lovely.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Each week, we spotlight a fabulous person like Rima Datta, who is living their bliss. So if you are anyone who is living their bliss, we would love to hear from you. I'm also on Insight Timer, the number one free meditation app. You can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook.
I would like to thank our wonderful guest, Rima Datta, for being on the show today. And thanks to everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrach, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.